And I'm not sure I want the money world being run by the people who think.
How is it that you know the word sclerotic but not the word stank?
If you take anything out of listening to this episode, this is that.
This is bothering me.
It says a lot about our relative vocabulary.
Listeners, and welcome to Season 2, Episode 54 of Bad Voltage. My name is Jeremy. I'm joined by Jono and Ak, as always. And we're going to kick it a little bit old school on this episode. No all-news episode. We have three topics that we're going to discuss, a la earlier episodes, I guess. We've been doing the news for a while, and we still enjoy it. Curious on your feedback on that. If you like the more meaty segments, or you prefer the news, a little bit of a mix of both, let us know what you think. But I think we're gonna hop right into it.
Yes. So I would like to talk about open source business models a little bit. So
unusually for us,
weird, eh? So there's a few elements to this that I think are interesting. So recently, there's been a lot of talk about different methods of licensing, right? We've seen the Redis stuff, the MongoDB stuff that's been going on. And I think it's been an identification that there is a risk in the eyes of some of these cloud providers that can essentially undercut the ability for these companies to make money. And as we've known for many years, there's been a whole range of different business models that are available in open source. And people use companies like Red Hat as an example, which is a really poor example because they're pretty unique in how they operate. But one of the increasingly common models here is OpenCore, where you've got an open source core project that I would refer to as the gateway drug. I mean, that's a negative connotation, but that kind of gets you interested and brings you in. You start using it. And then you start. Then the idea is that essentially there's some kind of upsell to a proprietary enterprise version. Now there are some models around this where the enterprise version is not proprietary, but it's limited in terms of licensing. Like dual licensing, for example, is one approach. Like MySQL did that, Qt did that. But what's becoming increasingly common, I'm seeing, is open source core project, and then a whole bunch of additional bits of functionality that sit on top of it in a proprietary project, right? And there's various people talking about this. I mean, this is hitting the press. There's this guy, Joseph Jacks, who's talking about it and going to do a conference on this and is blogging about it. There's various other people who are interested in this as well. And I just think it's a really interesting topic because I've worked with a few clients on this, and the relationship between these two different pieces is complicated because one element is how do you first of all, have an engineering workflow that is really open source. Like a lot of companies are identifying that developers are playing a big role in how decisions are made in terms of using software. So what they want to do is they want to go towards an open core model. But then they're realizing that maintaining an open source project is a lot of work if you've never done this before. And then secondly, if somebody, for example, builds a feature that replicates one of your commercial features in the proprietary version, should you accept that into your open source version? And if you don't set that expectation clearly, people have done a load of work and they're going to be frustrated about it. So I just think it's an interesting relationship. And I just thought, like, what do you guys think about this? Like, first of all, is this a model that people should be getting behind? Because it is one of the models that is working in open source. But secondly, what is the right way to do it?
Just out of curiosity for your definition of working, so we're all kind of on the same page here, do you have any examples of companies you think that it's working well for?
Yeah, I mean, I think a good example is HashiCorp. I think it's working well for them. I think it's working well for Mattermost. I think Scality are doing a good job with this. Like I think there are various firms who've taken this approach. I think Red Hat, in a way, has done this. But again, they're a poor example because they're
kind of... You think Red Hat is open core?
Well, no, I just mean like whereby they have like RHEL, and then some people would kind of get into that through Fedora. or CentOS back in the earlier days. It's not a pure open core model, obviously, but it's kind of the same principle of, I think, that the completely free thing brings people in. I'm just trying to think of other examples.
I mean, this is a topic I have so many opinions on that it's like my portion of this segment is like 2 hours long. So we have to rein it in a little bit, because to say I have
hold him back.
Such an understatement.
Try and boil it down to a few pithy,
1 hour.
A few pithy sound bites.
I think there's been a lot of talk recently about open source and bringing it maybe one level up from open core, specifically open source business models in general. And this is a topic that I think a lot of people have been interested in for a long time, and we've talked about quite a bit. But it's getting, as more and more money comes into the ecosystem, if you will, it's going to be talked about more and more. And I think a lot of the problem to me is that some of the companies you're reading the most about recently, part of their problem isn't their licensing, it's that they don't understand their business model or didn't have one to begin with. And I think there's been a few companies that started as an open source project maybe and really benefited from being open source, because just like with music, I think with software, in the very beginning, your problem, whether you're proprietary or not, it isn't piracy, if you will. It's obscurity. It's not being known. It's no one using your stuff, which is, I said, kind of the same. If you're a musician and you're brand new, you actually want people pirating your stuff because no one's heard of you to even pay for it.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of these companies bootstrapped on being open source, built a large community, and are now, because they took VC and didn't have a business model, trying to monetize in a way that makes their valuation acceptable, plausible, however you want to word it, justified is actually the best of them. And in many cases, I think the flat out answer is it isn't. And by taking too much VC, they put themselves in a no-win situation, and no amount of licensing changes is going to change that. And I think, to me at least, part of the problems I see is, A, I think smart companies try to commoditize their products' complements, right? And if you're a Mongo, the best complement for server-side software is being able to do it reliably, globally, redundantly, in a managed way that's very easy, that's on demand.
Exactly.
And I think if you look at the companies that are best suited to do that, it will never be Mongo. It's going to be Amazon. It's going to be Google. It's going to be Microsoft. So I think that by not following that tenet, they've put themselves in a tough position to justify their valuation. I think they're a great company at a certain valuation because they have a product that people want and they're doing well. It's just that they're trying to get to a valuation that I think is unrealistic for what they are. I think the second piece of this, and I think Docker is a great example of this, Mongo again, Redis would fall into this one. In the beginning, they intentionally branded their product in a way that was confusing where the product started and where the project ended. Right?
Yeah.
And Red Hat, the thing that blows my mind is everyone wants to be Red Hat because Red Hat makes all of the money. But no one is learning the lesson that Red Hat clearly learned when they changed the name of Red Hat Linux to Fedora. Right, they didn't want there to be confusion between what they were selling and the open source participation that they had. And Red Hat gets that both are important. They didn't play licensing games, but they wanted a clear, hard delineation between this is where the project ends and this is where the thing that you're paying money for starts. Because in the beginning, I think Docker learned this, the confusion actually benefits you because people are using Docker and Docker gets that name recognition and Docker's the company. But eventually that comes home to roost, right? Because it means, as a customer, I don't know where I start to pay Docker or where I don't, because the whole ecosystem is Docker. Where you know you don't pay for Fedora and you know you pay for RHEL, there's no free RHEL, there's no paid Fedora. There's a hard line. You understand the value that RHEL brings if you want RHEL, and if you want Fedora, that's cool too. But I think it's well understood. Yeah. So I think the confluence of those two things has caused much of where we are right now.
I agree with what you're saying entirely there. But it doesn't work if you start off as an open source project and then try and put together a company in order to provide consistent paid work on that project, because you are bootstrapping off the name. If you invent a brand new product, so you do the separation thing. So you say the commercial product is under this completely different name and it's not a name that anyone knows. Nobody's going to buy it because no one's heard of it. Your problem is obscurity. You're taking the one thing that you've done, which is get past the we are no longer obscure barrier, and throwing it away.
A good example of that actually is Canonical, in the fact that everybody had heard of Ubuntu. The traffic to Ubuntu.com and the traffic to Canonical.com were so different because people, the brand that everybody knew was Ubuntu, and Canonical for people in the know, knew that was the company that helped put, you know, that invested significantly in Ubuntu. Red Hat didn't have that because they were all one thing. But to Jeremy's point, they pivoted at the right time.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, and it wasn't, not that it wasn't a painful pivot, because it was, to be clear. Yeah. But
I mean, if you look at, take Canonical as not a bad example there. Canonical had a bunch of add-on products which were commercial, things like Landscape, right?
Yes.
But they couldn't trade on the fact that this was a thing built for Ubuntu, which everybody was using. If it was called Ubuntu Worldwide Global Server Manager or something, TM, right, then they probably would have had more people know about it. But it's a completely different product, entirely unconnected. And so not that many people bought it, which meant that they had to enforce the link between, if you're running Ubuntu, you want Landscape, in ways other than it just being part of the name. Now, I mean, Jeremy, I completely agree with your point. The blurring of the lines in between project and product makes things complicated for people. It makes it difficult to understand. Steve Wally goes on about this a lot, and he's completely right every time he does a talk about it. But I can see why you do it, because if you've managed to put together a company in order to productize this project, throwing away the one thing you've got, which is name recognition, the companies who did that, you've never heard about them. So they don't factor into our analysis because
Right? To go back to one of Jono's examples, I think Hashi is a counterexample there that proves that wrong. Right? There's no project called Hashi at all.
Right.
And I think of all the people doing this now, Hashi has the best model and is probably executing the best. They have a bunch of completely open source tools that are fantastic, from Terraform to Vault to Console. They're killing it. But they started
out that way, right? They started out with that branding.
They did. Mitchell has a vision and has executed on it super well. And I still think one of the best talks I've seen in the last couple of years was his keynote at Scale. But
right.
I think they've decided that a whole bunch of people are going to use their open source projects, do really cool stuff with them. There'll be an ecosystem of companies supporting those. And if you're a super large organization that wants to pay them a ton of money for a variety of different things, from support to services to whatever, they will talk to you. But if you only have a little bit of money, they actively do not want to talk to you, because they understand that's not where they make their money, right? They want to sell to large organizations, enterprises that have a lot of money and very strict specific demands, and that's how they want to scale the organization.
See, I think an element of this is the branding piece is, I think there are many different components here that all play a different role. You know, one of the lessons, again, going back to Canonical and Ubuntu, that I would suggest to other companies if they were starting down this road, is that there wasn't clarity when it came to the name of Ubuntu and the relationship between a Canonical and the community. I'll never forget the naming of Ubuntu One, which was really the first commercial product that was going to be incorporated into Ubuntu that had Ubuntu in the name, and it was a fucking controversy from all angles. Like, there was a huge amount of pushback from certain members of the community, and I think that gave Canonical at times a little bit of trigger fear about that kind of naming. And the first lesson here is, in my mind, is set those expectations up front, right at the beginning of a project, if you've got the luxury of doing so. Now, to be fair to Canonical and to Ubuntu, I don't think that was even a consideration in the early stages. But to me, the main thing is what you're building, does it add practical, pragmatic value that people are willing to pay for? Like, to me, this is where we can learn a lot from the SaaS model. So I'm sure you guys are the same. I use various SaaS services for my business where it makes sense, right? And I think a good example of this is Cloudflare. Cloudflare have their free plan. You can go and get some value out of it. You can see it working. But then to upgrade to the next level up, which is what, like 10 or 20 bucks a month, it's not particularly expensive, you get this raft of like security protection. So to me, it's like, you know, I think to myself, okay, what is the cost of Cloudflare and what is the cost of a potential intrusion? And it's a no-brainer. So therefore, spending the money is easily justifiable. And I think the thing with OpenCore, we're still figuring out what exactly that is. And from what I can tell, it's primarily around integration, right? So Mattermost are a good example of this. You can go and get Mattermost completely free. For those people who don't know Mattermost, it's a kind of like an alternative to Slack, completely open source. They have an enterprise version. And the real focus of the enterprise version is around integration into a company, right? So
things like SSO, SAML.
Exactly, all of that versions. Kind of stuff. Right. So it makes sense because a company's like, okay, we experiment with this thing and now we want to integrate it. And that's something we're willing to pay for because it's got a direct line to how a company operates. I don't think a lot of, I think the problem with a lot of open core businesses is that that value proposition isn't clear enough, right? So you can, you then potentially introduce a whole load of complexity around what's the relationship between this open source thing and this enterprise thing that may have the same name or a derived name. But I think you need to like do some market analysis to make sure that people actually want to buy the widget that you're putting out there.
So I think part of the issue, at least from my perspective here, is there's a perception, at least in the open source community, that open core is impossible to do well because there's always going to be a conflict between the community and the company. So if, right. Let's say company X has an open core product and they've chosen SSO as one of their proprietary things, because to be honest, that's one of the delineations that makes a lot of sense. Yes. Small organizations are not using SAML, and large organizations have money to pay for these things. So I get why you'd want to put the delineation there. And if I was someone in, on the business side, would make that decision. That aside, if a community member then decides to make a SAML add-on for your open source project, do you allow that? Will you accept it upstream? Will you maintain it then?
Right.
And because you're now a little bit conflating project decisions with product ones, there's going to be conflict. So you have to be really cognizant to manage that well. And if the answer is no, we won't accept it, it needs to be well communicated. And what if someone else releases it? How do you handle that? If they're going to have it outside, it will never be accepted officially, but what if it's really good and exists elsewhere? Like, that's going to either eat into your profits or cause contention. And it's, you know, it's, so there's a line to walk with open core that just doesn't exist elsewhere. So,
well, and the thing is,
I think that's part of the perceived issue with it.
And I think that issue is also what's behind someone like Mongo's anti-cloud provider license, server-side public license, right? Because it's exactly the same problem. It's some other entity. They're trying to put together a business model. Take a step back. I have a certain amount of sympathy for the situation they have found themselves in. I'm not sure I like the solution they've taken to get out of it, but I understand why they did it. Because the way you're describing it, if you have OpenCore, you have a project in the middle, the open source bit, and that's community focused and so on and so forth, and then you essentially sell proprietary add-ons to it. And, you know, you want to target those proprietary add-ons into things where they solve problems that people with money have. So the people with money will buy them. No problem with that at all. So then you've got the issue, what happens if someone competes with one of your proprietary add-ons? And from underneath, that competition comes from the community saying, I need this, I don't want to buy it, I'll write an open source version and release that. And then that's then competing with your proprietary version, and do you accept it into the project and so on and so forth. But from over the top, that's happening with the cloud providers, where the thing that they are offering on top of your project is the ability to run it at large scale in the cloud by clicking a couple of buttons without being an expert. And that's right. Also a proposition that you as a company are selling to people. Why would right. anyone bother to come to your company and ask for expertise when Amazon are handling it all for them instead? In the same way, why would anyone come to your company and buy your product when they can just download the open source one from GitHub, which is just as good? So that's the thing they're trying to deal with. And I understand that that's problematic if you run a company, especially since the issue we're talking about here is not someone basically owning an open source project and extracting monopoly rent from it. If that's all they were doing, I'd be like, well, you know, you don't have a business model. Sucks to be you, I guess. You deserve to die. That's competition. That's the way it works. But yeah. Realistically, if you try and say, hey, we can show you how to do this at scale, and Amazon say, we can show you how to do it at scale, no one is going to come to you for it. You can't compete with Amazon on that front, which means that if Amazon decide to do that bit of your business, you no longer have a business. It's not that you never had a business model. You did have one until Amazon just took it off of you.
So I think there would be some ways to approach this from a business perspective that are a little bit differently. I think in this specific case with Mongo, the one thing that's interesting to me is Amazon is not scaling Mongo and making it easier. They're scaling Aurora with a Mongo compatible API. So they did not take Mongo's code and scale it better. They took their API and used their existing backend.
Yes.
So no license, proprietary or otherwise, would have changed their ability to do that.
Yeah.
I think the thing is, I think one of the key underlying elements of this, and I think that this will, I'm confident that this will get better because this is just the nature of how people understand business models and workflow and learn from their lessons and improve on it. But I think one of the key driving forces behind this is the fact that a lot of companies, I think, are guilty of when they go into an open core model, is they want all of the benefits of being open source. So their messaging is all about, we're completely open and transparent and you can play a role in making a difference. And they put the trappings of a community in there. They have their developer events and they have open documentation and open pull requests and all that good stuff, right? But what they don't do is they don't have a open and transparent set of expectations around exactly this, around what is involved, what is that relationship. And my father-in-law, Joe, uses a term which I have been using increasingly, which is, I'd rather piss you off now than piss you off in 6 months' time, right, in terms of setting expectations. And I think what we need to see more of is where a company will say, for example, we're significantly investing in this open source project, right? And we are putting staff and infrastructure and all of this stuff into this. And we want to build a thriving community around this. And we have a promise that's kind of probably like the Ubuntu promise. We welcome everybody. It doesn't matter the gender, color of your skin, whatever else. We'll strive to make it available in your language. We'll respect accessibility, all of those pieces. But to say, we have to make money to do this. And the way in which we're going to make money is through integration features in our enterprise version. Therefore, if you submit a pull request for an integration feature to be included in the open source version, we won't accept it. Now, that doesn't mean, now this is, I think, is the important thing. So first of all, set those expectations clearly. Some people will be all pissed off about that and they won't participate in your project. That's fine. But you're going to save yourself a whole load of heartache in 6 months. But the second thing I think is that, you shouldn't stop people being able to make that integration feature, right? And they can stick it up in their own GitHub repo and you can go and get it yourself if you want to. But what you're not doing is you're not making it really easy for people to consume it. Like, I think one of the elements of open source done well, where businesses do well, is it's taking complicated bits of software and simplifying how people get access to it and use it, right? So to me, you could quite easily say, we won't incorporate any submissions, any pull requests into our core that replicate features or compete with our features in our enterprise version. But you're welcome to go and build those features and put them on GitHub. We're not going to stop you. We're not going to try and shut you down. We're not going to sue you or anything.
Oh, totally. The risk with that, though, is that then someone goes, okay, we're not submitting a feature which replicates one of your features. We're just submitting a feature which makes your API easier to interoperate with. In order that it makes it easier for us to build third-party add-ons. And then at that point, you either go, yeah, we'll include it, at which point you're making it just as easy. Because obviously people who are putting together the open source version want it to be easy, right? Yep. They're not going, no, we like it being difficult because right? Because we're open source elitists, and if it's not hard, then you didn't deserve it in the first place. Right? People don't actually think like that, except for a small minority. But it's when you start pushing that stuff upstream and then the company say, well, no, we're not going to accept that because it makes it easier for you to compete with us. Then you start looking like assholes rather than people just trying to protect their business model.
And there's always got to be a judgment, right? I just think that it's important at the beginning of these companies, and some companies don't have the luxury of doing this because they've already been around for a number of years or they started out one way and they pivoted. But I think it's important to set those expectations and then, but also say, like, we're not stopping you doing anything, right? We're not stopping you writing any code that integrates with this, right? The I think there are good and bad ways to protect your business model. And I think you always have to allow technical freedom, and you have to allow, like, the when people start blocking off APIs because of people using it in an incorrect way, or they you know, take down notices or whatever else, to me that can cause you all kinds of problems. But just, it doesn't mean you're going to be accepted under the tent, right? If you build something that competes. And then, but also saying, we're going to be reevaluating our position on this on a regular basis because companies change, policies change, and all the rest of it. But that, to me, is missing. Yeah. That a huge, not enough companies are doing that, because I think, frankly and cynically, a lot of companies, they want to come across as this big open organization, but they're not willing to talk about the fact that there's a whole set of unwritten rules that are going to dictate this kind of stuff. And those unwritten rules bubble up to the surface when someone submits a big piece of work in a pull request, and that pisses everybody off.
Yep.
I think that's a really important aspect. As you said, they'd like all the benefits of saying, look, we're an open company and anyone can get involved, but also the only people who get to take money out of it are them.
Right.
Which sits badly with everybody. But equally, I think the other side of that mirror is that you get all the deficits of both, in that everyone gets to compete with you and they get all the money, plus you have to do a bunch of work maintaining the open source project for people who basically don't care. Right. So straddling that fence is sometimes challenging. Yeah.
I think it's going to get easier, because as we've seen, it's amazing when I think back through some of the work we did when I was at Canonical, some of the both good decisions we made and bad decisions we made in retrospect are blindingly obvious, but at the time they weren't obvious, right?
But would that solution that's obvious now even have been the right solution then?
Right.
You know about sort of steam engine time, when it comes around and everyone's inventing steam engines because it's just kind of in the air.
Right.
I think there's a bunch of stuff where if Canonical is very good at coming up with an idea which is actually a good idea, just 4 years too early.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we've had that conversation before. The amount of things that Canonical was too far ahead of the curve on, astonishing.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing. Yeah. Someone needs to take Mark Shuttleworth, get an idea from him, and then lock him in a box for 4 years, and then let him come out and start working on it.
He's the only one I know that would benefit from his idea coming out later and not earlier. Like, everyone else wants a time machine because they wish they would have thought of it before. He needs to think of things later.
His foresight is uncanny. It is uncanny at best.
It is remarkable. Yes. Okay. So I don't think we're going to solve the problem of how to have an open source business model, but a bunch of thoughts.
You know what, though? John O'Bacon Consulting can solve that problem for you.
Hey! Less shilling of the business.
I'm kidding. And I am, of course, joking. Cryogenics Consulting can solve that problem for you, not John O'Bacon Consulting.
not that problem, but other.
But, you know, or Datadog. Datadog will let anybody into your world. So, anyway, what's next?
Well, since we were just since we were talking about Canonical, we should talk about Ubuntu's latest thing.
Yes,
over the last weekend. So a summary, which is as I understand it, Ubuntu. There are 64-bit and 32-bit versions of most Linux distros, and increasingly over the last few years, we've seen people dropping the 32-bit version, so 32-bit ISOs. And so on and so forth, because almost all hardware is now 64-bit, and you don't really need it. And obviously having to maintain two separate archives is, it's not quite double the effort, but it is certainly extra effort.
Yeah, it's work.
And so we've seen 32-bit stuff fall away in increasingly in more and more distros. What Ubuntu decided to do was that not just to drop the 32-bit ISOs, but actually to remove the 32-bit libraries from the distribution. So there's MultiArch, which is on a 64-bit machine, a 64-bit Ubuntu machine, you can install 32-bit libraries. And so if you've got 32-bit only applications, they can still use those libraries and they still work fine. Obviously, again, this is a bunch of extra work. And so some decision was taken that they should start talking about dropping those.
Right.
What wasn't taken into account was, I think, what wasn't taken into account sufficiently by whoever made that decision was three things. The first one is steam, the second one is wine, and the third one is half the printer drivers on Earth.
Really? I didn't know about the printer drivers thing.
All of which are those two.
Why? Is it because no one cares about printers and they haven't updated them? Is that...
printers, I believe, yeah. Brother printers are apparently a big thing for this. All their drivers are 32.
But isn't this all? Isn't this all cups?
The actual driver. Cups just throw stuff.
Cups
at the printer.
The service,
the printer
right?
Driver actually talks to the printer.
I can't believe we're talking about fucking printer drivers. What's happening? Anyway,
you
let's
didn't think
move
cups
on.
Was coming up today, did you?
Yeah, there it is. Be prepared. For something like these, you do get the impression Brother went, yeah, we're going to support Linux once in 2009 and wrote a driver. Right? But Steam, which has been where most of the pushback has come from, a lot of games are 32-bit. The Steam runtime is 32-bit, so I think all games are, actually, that run on Linux. But more importantly, even if you could wave a magic wand and make people stop writing games like that today, all the games that already exist won't change and they won't get updated.
Right.
It's not like open source software. People can just go back and recompile it. Half the games on Earth can't be recompiled because nobody's got the source code anymore. And this is not like, you know, Zork 1. This is stuff that was written 3 years ago.
Right. So my understanding of this is many games actually are 64-bit. Almost all installers are 32-bit.
Right, and the Steam runtime is 32-bit. I don't understand the intricacies of it myself, but there was certainly a suggestion that, we thought about Steam and games and stuff, and just run it in a container or something, it'll be fine.
Yeah, snapped for their answer.
Yeah, and it turns out that might be an answer in the fullness of time, but it's certainly not an answer right now, this moment, because there's a bunch of work.
So does this mean that? So this means that basically Steam are not going to be building. Well, so the 32-bit client, Steam client, it will stop working in Ubuntu. Is that right?
Well, so what happened? First of all, was this got announced? It blew up. His name's not Pierre Loup Guru, but it's something like that. The guy who works for Valve, announced, Valve will no longer be supporting Ubuntu 19.10 and future versions. It's unclear just how official a comment that is.
But he works for Valve.
He works for Valve. Yeah,
it's probably pretty official.
So it's reasonably efficient. Yeah, absolutely. But then, on the other hand, he's just a guy. But on the other hand, Valve don't really have a kind of a hierarchical structure. And
yeah, but was this? I mean, was this like a errant tweet that came out, or was this a statement?
No, this is the point. It was just a tweet.
Okay.
It was a tweet saying, Valve aren't going to support Ubuntu 19.10. And
well, good news. Good news for Valve is that if there's a big, you know, riot about this, they can walk that one back easily.
Well, absolutely. And it seems that Canonical, the bits of Canonical who took this decision have gone, ooh, blimey, there's been a lot of pushback about this. What, to my mind, is interesting here is I don't know how the internal decision process went. Right, but I think at least some of the people taking the decision were surprised at the virulence of the pushback, and so Canonical published a blog post on Monday, the 24th, basically saying, wow, blimey, you're all really shouty about this. Okay, we're probably not going to do that then.
Right.
But
as in Canonical are going to continue to support multi-arch?
Yes, basically for the plan is still for it to go away eventually, but I mean they would say whoever would say this would say, but we've been talking about this for years and none of you chipped into those discussions till we said you were
so the initial threat on this, to be clear, started in 2014.
Yeah, people have been talking about dropping 32-bit forever. And, I mean, there are people who are still moaning about the fact that the latest Ubuntu, you can't download an Ubuntu ISO for 18.04 or 19.10 or whatever, and have it run on your compact laptop from 2005 because it's 32-bit.
Right.
So it all gets a bit tangled up in community discussions. But so, I don't know, I'm interested in your thoughts.
The one thing I was confused about in the updated blog statement from Canonical, it said, after the Ubuntu 18.04 LTS release, we had extensive threads on Ubuntu Devel and consulted with Valve in detail. So if they consulted with Valve in detail, I'm curious why this came out via a tweet. It seems like they were either consulted in detail, they came up with a decision, and there should have been a little more understanding than one of their developers tweeting out, we will evaluate ways to minimize breakage for existing users, but we'll also switch our focus to a different distribution, currently TBD, was the tweet. That doesn't sound like collaboration to me.
I do not understand what went on there. If they consulted with Valve in detail, I would have assumed that the consultation resulted in a plan to continue supporting Steam while dropping 32-bit libraries from the archive. That obviously wasn't the case.
Which I think is what Leap did, right? SUSE did something similar to that. They dropped 32-bit, but they ensure that Wine 32-bit and therefore Steam 32-bit.
I was going to say, can you essentially have a specific wrapper that goes around, you know, a whitelisted set of applications?
Which is what Canonical is doing now, right? They're just shipping the multi-arch bits from 1804 in 2004.
Yes, and I believe they're going to cut down the list of libraries that are in there. So it's all the ones that Steam and what have you need, but they're not going to ship the whole archive as multi-arch anymore.
Right. Which seems reasonable to me. I mean,
because the hard work with multi-arch was getting multi-arch to work. Now that it works, it's not a lot of ongoing maintenance.
Right. Well, I'm guessing it's just rebuilding a ton of software, right?
Well, as I understand it, it's more work than that because otherwise they wouldn't care about dropping it, right? When they said, and we want to drop this, it wasn't because, wow, it's so much effort to just have to type I386 into the build daemon and then never think about it again. It is actually more work than that.
It's going to be...
And they want to reduce that amount of work. So, I mean, I think there are good reasons for wanting to do this. I wonder, I'd be really interested to know whether this is basically a game of chicken playing out in public, where Canonical went, we're going to drop this stuff, and Valve went, we don't want you to. And Canonical went internally, huh, well, maybe we'll say we're going to drop it, and then you'll have to go along because you're not going to walk away from Ubuntu. And Valve went, yeah, we are.
Valve wins that 100% of it. I don't know who made that decision internally, but they need to reevaluate how they make decisions.
To be clear, this is outright superstitious guesswork on my part. I have literally no knowledge about this, and to the extent that I could have found out knowledge, I have deliberately avoided doing so. So I know nothing about the internal process here, and I don't want to know.
Show title, deliberate ignorance.
On a related note, I don't know what Canonical's priority, where this kind of thing fits in the priorities. I'm a bit confused by this right now with Canonical, because clearly, you know, so when Canonical decided to stop investment into Unity, right, there was an assumption that it was all going to be focused on cloud and server stuff. And obviously that's a big piece of Canonical's business. But there's a lot going on at Canonical on the desktop, right? There's the whole desktop team being maintained. They're putting out distributions regular as clockwork. There's been a lot of engineering work has gone into GNOME Shell and integrating that. There's a lot of work that's gone into Snappy on the desktop. So clearly the desktop is still very much an area of interest for Canonical. What I don't know is, in these kinds of situations, how important is Steam in the broader picture of things? Like, if Canonical knows that Steam has got to be a killer app for a lot of Ubuntu users. And if that goes away, and therefore a lot of people may either switch distributions or they may move to a Mac or a Windows box or whatever, I don't know. What I don't know is how bad that would be in the scheme of things, because
I don't know either. I mean, I'm assuming that it would be bad precisely because otherwise they'd have gone, no, we're doing it. If we lose Steam, we don't mind, whatevs. And they didn't do that. So it must be...
Well, we're seeing part of the picture, to be fair. We are.
But totally. I think part of the lesson learned from what Red Hat did when they de-emphasized the desktop is super large enterprises are going to use whatever they use on the servers. They probably came from Sun or AIX or something like that, HPUX, and they went to RHEL. I think a whole meaty section in the middle whatever their developers use on the desktop, they will end up using on the server. And I think a lot of those companies went from using Red Hat Linux, not RHEL, to using Ubuntu, because when Red Hat de-emphasized the desktop, their developers switched to Ubuntu. So I think the reason that at all that Ubuntu or Canonical cares about the desktop is that losing a bunch of those developers in 18 months means they probably lost too much cloud for them to bear, given where their margins, I'm guessing, are. And I know out of the three of us, I'm the only one that hasn't worked at Canonical. So to be clear, when they're totally guessing, I'm guessing with less background information. So even more wild speculation than those two. But I'm giving that they understand that. Like, that's a lesson that's learned. I think everyone agrees that's why a lot of it happened. So losing that desktop developers specifically, and a lot of developers happen to game. So I think that's where the important pieces come into place.
That's kind of what I was getting at as well, was the importance of desktop developers using the desktop is very clear. Canonical's been talking about this for many years. This has been a really prevalent form of, I think, the snappy strategy, as well as just the general Ubuntu strategy. What I don't know is the relationship with gamers. And that I'm presuming it's probably difficult because a lot of developers are gamers, right? First of all. So, from what I understand, I'm not really a gamer. So I've not really used Steam in any great level of detail, but the implementation on Ubuntu is pretty good. And there's a lot of games, not everything, but there's a lot of games there. So to lose that, the Steam piece, I can imagine would be a real, if you are a developer using Ubuntu, would be a problem. But then also, of course, there's going to be a whole ton of people who are just hobbyist Ubuntu users, who are not developers, who are reading DistroWatch, right, and Phoronix and whatever else, who, if you lose those folks, it's less critical from Canonical's perspective, possibly.
I think you're also avoiding a very large chunk of people who are hobbyist users. So they're not developers, but they're also not part of the community. They're not reading Phoronix. They're not reading DistroWatch.
Probably the majority of people are those people.
I'd say it's not only a majority, it's a massively, massive supermajority.
That's actually an interesting question. I wonder what proportion of just one community, let's say Ubuntu, I wonder how many of them are, like, nerds compared to just general users.
I wish I knew. I mean, I have the impression that the nerds are a very small piece of the overall pie for Ubuntu. I'm not sure it's the case for other distributions, and that's the point. And so if you lose that, more of a problem. But those people are kind of invisible. They're not participating in the community, so you're not seeing their voices.
Yep.
Terribly mixed metaphor, sorry. You're not hearing their voices.
You're not smelling their colour.
Well, exactly. App get installed, synesthesia.
Don't you mean snap install?
There's actually an app called that.
Well, we'll have to...
No, I don't you mean snap install synesthesia.
We'll have to see how this all plays out. I mean, I'm curious to see what happens.
I mean, it seems like for the near term it played out, right?
Huh?
It seems like in the near term it played out.
But I'm curious to see if there's going to be any backtracking on any reversal of position.
So I'm also curious to see now that this is clearly on the table or was on the table, if Steam's position is, you already dropped this on us, we're going to use a different, like, we're going to focus on a different distro anyway, be that Debian or something else.
Well, if Steam go, well, we've been burned now, man, that's it. You lost your one chance. Which would be a bit...
I'd be surprised,
I wonder what the role of Linux is in the Steam strategy right now as well. Because I know that the Steam boxes run Linux, right?
Steam OS was much more of a thing before and is now much less of a thing.
So
I think what they wanted it to be was a key part of the strategy, and that's why they built all the Steam machines and Steam OS, with the idea that this would provide an alternative platform just no one really
wanted. Or they wanted it as a bargaining chip.
Yeah. What the discussions are like internally at Valve now that didn't work, I don't know.
All right. Well, I don't know about you guys, but I'm bored of talking about Steam. What's next?
Next up. So recently, I'll read a little bit of TechCrunch article about this. We're going to talk about Facebook Libra. I'll read, like I said, one paragraph just to kind of do an intro, and then I'll give the facts as I understand them, and then curious what you both think from there. So,
all right.
Facebook has finally revealed the details of its cryptocurrency, Libra, which will let you buy things or send money to people with nearly zero fees. You'll be able to anonymously or pseudo-anonymously buy or cash out your Libra online or at local exchange points like grocery stores and spend it using interoperable third-party wallets or Facebook's own Calibra wallet. And it will be built into WhatsApp, Messenger, and its own the actual Facebook app. So they released a white paper on this, and we can link to it in the show notes. But a couple salient points from my perspective. So this isn't like Bitcoin. It's what's called a stable coin, which the value is pegged to a group of low volatility currencies. Right now, it looks like the U.S. dollar, the Japanese yen, and the euro combined. Interestingly, they have the right to change this at any time, from what I can tell. So also, unlike Bitcoin, Facebook and its partners, it started out with about 2 dozen of these. They want 100 by the time it launches. They're called validators. They're going to run a proprietary blockchain, and this network will kind of govern all the reserve assets. And once they accrue enough assets in this, they'll actually be able to make money from the kind of the VIG and getting interest on it. So some of the launch partners were Spotify, Uber, eBay, Andreessen Horowitz, PayPal, Visa, MasterCard. They all had to put in $10 million. And have a couple of bars met as far as either $1 billion valuation or $500 million in cash, et cetera. They also allowed some charities in to quote unquote keep them honest. and those will be the founding members.
Hold it. Let him continue.
So they do aim, they claim, for this project to be fully quote unquote permissionless. Rather than permissioned, so while they will have obviously a say in how it was launched, within 5 years they want to transition away from that validator structure to a traditional proof-of-stake network. Like I said, they aim to have 100 of those validators by 2020 when they launch. They also are on the record as saying they're enforcing a strict separation between users' social data, which their Facebook likes, photos, all that stuff, and the financial data, which they're separating out into that Calibra wallet. And like as I mentioned, when the critical mass is achieved and reserves are flush, the Libra Association will be able to reinvest some of that reserve capital into low risk securities and treasury bonds, things of that nature. And one last thing that I thought was interesting, they have confirmed that they're going to be very, very anti money laundering, very anti this being used by criminals, and have stated that they will work with law enforcement to combat those criminals, anyone attempting to siphon funds or use the black market, dark web, etc. And they will give up your know your customer data, which is your passport photo and proof of residence, if warranted. So with that out of the way, what do you two think of this Facebook Libra?
You know, if you had just walked through all of that and it was from somebody other than Facebook, it would be interesting.
Yep.
I just don't trust them.
So I think, go ahead, sorry.
No, all I was going to say was... I am disappointed that if I have to live in a corporate-controlled dystopia like Neuromancer that I don't get an Ono Sendai deck and I just get a Dell XPS instead. It's rough.
Even more skeptical than I guessed here, to be fair.
Let me clarify my comment. It's not that I don't trust Facebook. I think that the people who were there, I have no doubt, are good people, and I think they're doing the best that they can. And I think they've been under a lot of scrutiny that you know, it's really hard to experience the level of growth that they've experienced, right? And I think they've tried, you know, you become basically one of the most central digital places on the planet. Right. And
I'm sure the pile of money the size of the building.
Well, hang on. Just because you make a lot of money doesn't make the problem any easier, right? These are two separate things. You're making a shitload of money, but I have no doubt that being able to react to the scale and the scrutiny and the pressure of Facebook is a hard job, and people are fallible, right? And and they make mistakes. I'm not denying that for a second, right? The problem I think that they're going to have is that years ago we talk about Facebook and issues with privacy. And one of the things that we always used to say was we in the tech world know that this is a problem, but it's not percolated into the general consumer base because people don't tend to care about privacy as much. I think that the 2016 election hacking news changed a lot of that, and people are now much more aware of their privacy than they ever were. because they're hearing stories about government state-sponsored hacking. They heard about it as it related to an election. So I think Facebook have got a stank that's attached to them right now that they're obviously trying to deal with. They've got significant advertising campaigns going into this, but I think their brand is tarnished. And I you've got this brand that is, people are snickering about as being a lack of security, and Zuckerberg not particularly caring about this, and his deeply hydrated appearances in front of the government, and now we're talking about a financial mechanism like this. I just think that some people, I think it's going to be a struggle for them to sell it.
Yeah.
So I think good people at Facebook, many good people, but they've got to fix their brand.
I think it's a fascinating dichotomy that the Facebook's network and their scale is the biggest reason to believe that Libra has a chance to work. But
right.
Facebook's brand is the biggest reason to believe that it will not work.
You summarized it perfectly. Yeah.
If they have a stank, that's a word, is it?
Okay. Yeah, it's a stank.
I'm down indeed with a the word. Kids.
Have you not heard the word stank, given all of your waffling about your library and how much you read and how the book is always better than the fucking movie? You've never heard the word stank before?
I don't think I've read any books written in the last 3 minutes, so no.
You need to read more Snapchat.
Apparently I do. So, given that their brand is tarnished, which I entirely agree with everything you said there, I'm not sure the way to solve that is to say, it's okay, because with our tarnished brand, we're going to set up a system where we take a penny out of every financial transaction on Earth. Oh, it's fine, though, because Uber are checking we're doing it.
When you put it that way.
Yeah, it's interesting that they very much
I did very much like the fact that they had the couple of charities on there. It's like, I can't possibly be a rapacious capitalist because, look, some of my best friends are charities. Check these guys out.
Wow, man.
Yeah, I thought I would be the most cynical here, and I might be the least of the three, which is astonishing, given my opinions.
It will not surprise you to hear that I do not like this idea. But I think, to be honest with you, my major problem with this is something we've spoken about before, the issue of large tech companies taking on some of the role of public utilities, but without any of the oversight and control that public utilities have. I've got a whole load of problems with how the government works, how central banking works, all that. But there is some small measure of oversight. Yeah. Setting up a currency, and they've said, we're not going to do monetary policy. Right? How many times have you set up a company and said, "Oh, we're not going. We promise to not do any monetary policy which affects how money works across the whole world."
So I think right? that
for most people, this doesn't come up. The fact that they're going, "Yeah, we're not going to do that," means they have the potential to do so. And if they decide to do so, no one can do anything about it. They're an unelected, unrestrained, uncontrolled central bank that you can't avoid.
So one thing that fascinated me, as I kind of just thought this through a little bit last night, is that I think the aim of this, at least to me, is probably not the US or the UK, at least initially, right? I think Facebook's presence in developing economies is massive, to the point in many places to almost being synonymous with the internet, like AOL used to be here, right? But I think a lot of people in those economies, they can't monetize, right? Because they don't have money or they don't buy. So all the ads that Facebook uses to make the money that they make just aren't a thing, right? So as a result, ads are useless, and ads is how they make their money. So if enter Libre, where they're getting those people, the unbanked, which is a word I'm tired of hearing, but they get those unbanked to become part of the machine and spend money and become eyeballs. So I think this is specifically targeted at developing countries, and I don't think that's lost on developing countries. You're seeing India just proposed a law where holding, selling, or dealing in cryptocurrency, and they use Bitcoin as an example, but any cryptocurrency which this would apply, is jailable for 10 years at a minimum and is not a bailable offense. So they won't even let you out on bail.
Yeah.
So I think if you're a developing country, you're not going to be happy about this, because if a large part of your citizenry starts losing this, you lose control of independence over your monetary policy, which is one of the most important policy tools that you have.
So
yeah, and this is exactly the thing. They are not stupid. They're looking at this and going, hey, we could have our entire country ending up being owned by this company. Like, I mean, you've heard the phrase Banana Republic, right? Not the shop.
Yes, we've heard of
it. I'm impressed that you know that there's a shop called Banana Republic. I pegged you more of a Marshalls guy.
Now, see, them I've not heard of, so I don't know whether that's insulting.
They make great amps.
That's really unfair. Right, okay, them I've heard of. But the point about the phrase Banana Republic was that there were small countries which were essentially owned by Dole, the fruit company, yeah. Right? And they had control over and above what anyone else in the country had, including the government. And I think a lot of developing economies are looking at this and going, they're trying to do that. Get out of town. No way are we doing that. And India have the leverage, the capacity to actually lay down a law like this and make it stick.
I have no doubt in my mind that Facebook, they're looking at WeChat in China and they're saying we want that.
Yeah.
So for listeners who are either not from China or are less familiar with this, WeChat is not just, a lot of people think of WeChat as being, you know, kind of a little bit like WhatsApp, you know, a chatting tool, like Slack.
It is not that.
It's absolutely everywhere. Like, there's whole platforms built on it. People buy things with it. They scan in QR codes.
You pay your taxes on WeChat.
It's everywhere, and it's deeply ingrained into the Chinese culture. And I think Facebook are identifying almost certainly that that's what they want.
Yeah.
To me, this is outside of the, is this a good idea or not? I think there's a huge marketing problem with it, because to me, you know, putting aside people like us who are technically interested in this kind of stuff, if you want to get access, if you want the average Joe and Josephine to use your monetary platform, right, then you've got to be able to get it to them in really simple and accessible terms that are going to be better for their wallet overall, mm-hmm. right? And I think that Facebook, A, have struggled a little bit with that, right? They've built a preeminent social media platform that loads of people use, but a lot of the features in Facebook aren't getting used. Like, we talked about this a while back about all of the marketplace stuff and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. There's tons of features in Facebook that never get seen, I think, by most people. In the same way that a small proportion of people used all of the features in Microsoft Word. And that's one of the reasons why Google Docs, I think, has been so successful. They focused on the most basic critical things and made it easily accessible for people. So I think
the Microsoft Word team, just to interrupt slightly, the Microsoft Word team have heard this argument and they claim, sure, any one given person only uses 10% of Word.
So it's a different 10%.
But it's always a different 10%. And I have a certain amount of sympathy with that argument. I mean, I've never used a pivot table in my life in Excel. I barely even understand what a pivot table is. But if I went, you don't need that, half the people using Excel would
for
cry
sure.
their eyes out. The other half of the people using Excel are using it to keep shopping lists in and things like that and could care less about any of the mathematics.
No,
functions.
Exactly.
So,
but I think what's going to happen here is...
Yes, it's off the board.
What worries me here is because of the very, very public... brand tarnishing of Facebook, mm-hmm. they're focusing on, even if they were to convince the tech world that they are going to be good stewards and citizens of doing this, this platform is unbelievably complicated to understand. I think I understood 60% of what you walked through, Jeremy, when you summarized it. So the general public, first of all, are going to be confused by the concept of this, right? Because most of the people in the general public, they think money goes from my employer into my bank, and then I use my credit card to pay for my thing.
So I think, at least from what I saw of the UI, the UI actually is frighteningly simple. That's why I think the cryptocurrency this most looks like on the back end is probably Ripple. I think some of those folks are a little bit nervous that because of that shiny UI in the front, other cryptocurrencies are going to suffer, actually, because of this is much simpler.
Oh, okay. But
And to be honest with you, I agree with you. Most people, me included, think money, you know, comes from the people who pay me, and then I use it to buy lager. But they don't understand what M2 is and what monetary policy is and what the role of the Fed is and so on, and yet they can still use money.
Yeah.
No one has to understand how Libra works under
the covers. Yeah, but the thing is, and this kind of gets to the point that you made earlier on, Ak, is that I think a lot of people think the monetary systems that we have are regulated very tightly by the government, and there may be people who have arguments again, more or less regulation, putting that to one side.
Yeah.
There is a view that they are regulated, but then you hear that there is a monetary system that's coming into place that is stewarded by Facebook, and then they think to themselves, Facebook are those people who don't have very good privacy and influence, let a bunch of influence through for the election, whatever else. If I was Facebook, I'd be worried about these two sides, because I think what they're doing is interesting, and I want them to succeed. In the same way, I want them to succeed in their privacy. Like, I don't want them to fail by any stretch. I think Facebook is kind of cool, but they've got to be able to bridge these two bits.
To me, I think they have two huge problems to adoption here. The one is that they've promised to not mix transaction data with profile data, right? But that fundamentally, what that requires is trust in Facebook, and I think they've lost that. So right. In that regard, I think they're going to have a huge uphill battle. The other uphill battle, and I'm going to take three large but differing economies here. So let's lump US, UK into one. We'll do India as one, and we'll do China as one.
Right.
So three, I think one's super developed, one's very developed, and one's still developing. I think the US went from cash to credit cards, and the benefits far outweighed the pain of moving from that. China skipped that. They went right from cash to WeChat and Alipay and those kinds of digital things. And once again, I think the benefits far outweighed the pain. India's made clear they're not interested in the digital aspect, and it's a jailable offense. So it's immediately off the table there. So let's go back to the US, UK, and let's go back to China. China's already all digital. So the benefit from where they are with Alipay and WeChat to this, there's almost no benefit, and there is pain because you're switching platforms. In the US, we're already mostly on credit cards and a little bit of digital. The incremental benefit from credit card to this is not very large, and there's a lot of pain. So I think the two huge swings you already saw in the US, UK, and in China were because the benefits far outweighed the pain. I don't see that here for any of the three major classifications of economies that we're willing to have. And given that, I don't know where this succeeds. It may be very small. Like
that's
Africa,
a good point,
I could
Jeremy.
Maybe,
that's a
but yeah. other than that, I just don't see it happening.
That's a really neat way of describing it. I never thought about it from that perspective. Yeah,
that's very reasonable, especially since if you look at the US, I mean, I know I've complained to you two about this before, but I'm still astounded by the mind-blowing undertaking up of contactless payments in the US. Because I thought that would be a genuine big advantage that people would go for. I mean, basically everything here is contactless.
Yes, glory.
Every time anyone pays for anything, it's contactless. In the US, I assumed that it didn't get that way because the banks were all terrible and sclerotic and everything, and then Apple and Google came in to save us and made it convenient, and everyone still hasn't adopted it. You still have to sign for everything all the time. Now you sign on an iPad. So the idea that this will suddenly become a thing you can walk into shops and use, I'm not sure I buy. And some of this is bank, sclerotic regulations and so on. But I reckon probably the reasons why dealing with banks is a pain in the arse, 50% of it is because banks are all terrible and don't get anything done. And the other 50% is stuff which is there for a good reason. Right. But it doesn't look like it's a good reason at first blush. So if you go, we're going to sweep away all the old stuff and not have any of that, then yeah, you do get to look like you move really super duper fast and everything. Until the first time someone makes a payment on your account and you go, oh, well, if it's my credit card, then I'm entitled to get that money back, regardless of whether I was guilty of it or not.
The move fast, break things mentality turns out doesn't work if you were receiving a payment and didn't get it.
Exactly. That's precisely the point. But it looks like, because you can say to people, look at all these terrible things there are about dealing with banks and money, and anyone can name 50 of those. But when you sweep it all away, you also sweep away the 50 things which are there to protect you, which a certain kind of, it's probably unfair to call it a Silicon Valley mentality, but I'm going to. Sees that as being just getting in the way of business.
So how is it?
And I'm not sure I want the money world being run by the people who think.
How is it that you know the word sclerotic but not the word stank?
If you take anything out of listening to this episode, this is that.
This is bothering me.
It says a lot about our relative vocabulary. Sorry, Jono. It says a lot about the words you know and the words
that I know. Oh, very nicely done. Very nicely done. We should think about wrapping it up.
We should.
Going on for a while. So I think these are three topics with a lot more to discuss. And definitely everyone go and join the community. Go to community.badvoltage.org, or you can go to our Slack channel and go and let us know what you think. There's a lot to unwrap here.
There is.
Yeah, so go and check it out. Anything exciting coming up for either of you fellas?
I don't believe so. Not in the next two weeks, no.
No. All right. Well, it's been real.
Wicked. This has been Bad Voltage. Thank you very much.
Bye. Goodbye.
Goodbye.